This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, Connecticut. I am Pedlin Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It is August 9th, 2017. Wow, August 9th. Whew. Welcome to Bicycle Talk, this week with my co-host, the lovely Fran Stort.
Hi!
A show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, you can call or text to 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or visit Bicycle Talk on Facebook. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you would like to contribute or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Enough of the business side of things. Moving on a positive side. Okay, a positive side. This is a part where we talk about something that's really good and great and wonderful that's happening in cycling. And I will say two words. Saul Nesselroth. Saul Nesselroth is a friend of ours who is...
Wow,
he is 90 years old, and he is going to be riding a 90-kilometer bicycle ride for his 90th birthday. Now, he already had his birthday, but he has wanted to do this, and he thought 90 miles is probably too far, so 90K is definitely something that will be within his range. It's actually a little out of his range, but he's going to do it anyway, and he's going to be joined by a number of riders from the area that are going to ride with him and support him for the ride. So a big tip of the cycling cap to those riders that are supporting him.
And my girl Cindy, my guy Martin.
Yep, and another big, and Mary also.
And Mary Dean.
Mary Dean also. So a big tip of the cycling cap to them, and a giant tip of the cycling cap to Saul Nesselroth. So happy birthday, Saul. Ron's rant of the week. Moving on. Cyclist haters. So people who hate people on bicycles, what's with that? That's a waste of energy. It's a real waste of energy. But, of course, as I'm fumbling about on the internet, I find a Facebook page that is called The Cycling Rant, and which I thought was kind of funny. And so anyway, the rant was, so we are back and we have been researching how to identify cyclist haters on Facebook. On Facebook, get this, based on comments such as "Hey Rigo," which I don't know what that means, or "run them over," we have identified the common traits you should look for. Number one, they all seem to attend the same school, the School of Hard Knocks, or they go to the University of Life. These are the people that hate cyclists the most.
What does that mean?
That means that when you identify your, and this, it's very interesting because, you know, I don't identify myself that way, but I do have I have a different way of identifying myself because I didn't really have any further education that I attended.
Right.
That's basically what it is. They drive Mount Druitt Mercedes, i.e. 1997 Commodore wagon, or a 4x4 with stupid big tires of any type. So that's another identifying factor. These are things that are in common with people that have, this was researched on Facebook to what the common pieces that they had that came together. Their kids have rat tails and seem to be called Den, as in Brayden, Kaden, and Jaden. That's kind of funny. And all politicians are, I can't use the word because we are on public radio, that steal our money, and politicians should have attended the University of Life. I rant on that sometimes. They know that such is life, quote unquote, where Ned Kelly's last words, he was an Australian bush ranger, by the way, and they know that saying, and they may have it tattooed on them in case they forget. And these are also people, now I'm not making this is not my generalization here. This is what I found on this page that is called The Cycling Rant. They hate Muslims and believe they are the root of all evil,
aww,
even though they have never met one.
No.
Even though they've never met one, which shows you just exactly what you're dealing with when you have this person who is, you know, screaming
at
you.
You
shouldn't hate anyone.
No, you shouldn't hate anyone.
You shouldn't hate anyone. But they not only hate cyclists, they also
hate
other
Muslim,
people of other religious sects, which is really silly.
I have a couple of Muslims in my life that I love. That just makes me really sad.
And I don't know what this means. It says REGO, REGO will fix everything. If we pay it instantly, all cycling issues will disappear. I just don't understand what that means. Anyway, they hate police. All police do is revenue chase. They think police actually teach, I think the police actually teach this at the School of Hard Knocks. They believe that, this is a cyclist, are all homos for wearing Lycra. Got it. Yet, most of them have done time in male prisons. this is a really funny rant. So they are still upset that the great author Chopper Reed died. Mark Brandon Chopper Reed was an Australian criminal and author, as they are the only books they have ever read. If you know anyone that fits more than four of these points, deep down, they hate you. So that was just kind of a silly thing. I thought I'd bring it up in the rant. It was humorous, so I wanted to bring it up. I got a piece from my friend Tony, who is out in the Hartford area, who is probably listening right now. Hopefully I haven't made him fall off of his chair while at work with all the other employees around him watching. Apparently I've cracked a smile or two to him. Shout out to Tony. And he sent me a thing about more New Yorkers. This is from the New York Times. More New Yorkers are opting for life in the bike lane. Biking has become part of New York's commuting culture as the city expands bike routes and city bikes become ubiquitous. So there are more than 450,000 daily bike trips in New York City. How about that? So anyway, this is something that is growing. It's a phenomenon. And what is happening now, because this is growing, if you take a look, the New York City has, you know what city bikes are, Fran? You're familiar with what city bikes are?
Yes.
They're the shared bicycles.
Sure, I've seen them.
That are in a lot of the cities now. You see them in Chicago, you see them in Boston, you see them in L.A., you see them all around, and also in New York City. The New York's commuting infrastructure, the biking has become part of New York City's commuting infrastructure. The bike routes have expanded, and a fleet of 10,000 city bikes have been deployed in more than 600 locations. Today, there are more than 450,000 daily bike trips in the city, and up to 170,000 in 2005, an increase that has outpaced population and employment growth, according to city officials. About one in five bike trips is by a commuter. Shout out to New York. Look at this. So there's, this story goes on. It talks about a person, Tim Wang, 30, who's a nurse, who traded the subway for a bike after the train delays kept making him late for work. It takes about 25 minutes for him to bike to his job compared to an hour on two trains. How about that? It's faster to take a bicycle in New York City than it is to take the train. So then he actually ended up buying a second bike as a spare just in case. So he's got a backup bike just in case one bike has got a mechanical issue or a flat tire or whatever. And he says now that he has a bike, he goes more places more often because it's more convenient. So this is a pretty cool thing. City bike alone accounted for a record 70,286 trips last Wednesday, which the program called the highest single day ridership on any system in the Western world outside of Paris. 70,000 trips a day on city bikes.
Wow.
That's incredible. The bike sharing system in New York has signed up 130,000 riders for annual memberships and up from nearly 100,000 last year. So increase of 30,000 additional riders for bike share in New York City. This is amazing thing. Now, you know, if it happens in a place like New York, this is extremely important because, you know, places like New York and places like California, they kind of, you know, set the pace for what happens in the rest of the world. And, or the rest of our world, let's say. The rest of the world, they are very aware of bicycle commuting. And you just go over to Europe and you'll see that it is a norm, not an oddity as it is here. So in the past 2 years, proposals to add bike lanes in Manhattan and Queens have drawn opposition from residents. Of course, they don't want to see that. Those horrible polluting bicycles, polluting their neighborhoods. In an email to the community board on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, Woody Allen, who lives in the neighborhood, said that while he was in favor of encouraging bicycling, this is quote unquote, unfortunately, the situation has gotten off to an unregulated start and is out of control. Okay, the bike lane was built on his street anyway. Ha ha ha, Woody Allen. That'll teach you to complain. So anyway, even famous people like Woody Allen, they like bikes, but they don't want them in their neighborhood. You heard that one before, huh? That's kind of like the bike path story where, you know, well, you know, those bike paths are really nice, but I don't want it going through my neighborhood because it'll bring the wrong type. I can't stand the arguments. They drive me nuts. So, anyway, this has become a really, really big thing in New York. You can go to the New York Times and you can find the article there. Chicago also has a sprawling network of bike routes, including a stretch over an abandoned railroad line that was repurposed as a trail. The city's bike share system, which is called DIVVY, has more than 6,000 bikes and covers 100 square miles, the largest area in the country. Los Angeles has 796 miles of bike lanes. Listen to that. 796 miles of bike lanes in Los Angeles alone, up to 545 miles 5 years ago. So they've increased dramatically in the number of bike lanes that they put into their city. It has turned one downtown street into a laboratory for bike safety, experiments, testing lights, signal lights, just for bike lanes, painted green bike boxes near busy intersections that give riders a place to wait before making left-hand turns. Portland, Oregon, 370 miles of bike routes, including neighborhood greenways that give priority to bicyclists on local streets by lowering the speed limit to 20 miles per hour. Yay, Portland. Good thing for Portland. We have other things to talk about with them. And strategically placing bollards to divert car traffic. In addition, the city began requiring protected bike lanes to be built on streets adjacent to new buildings. So if you're building a new building in Portland, you have to put a bike lane next to it. This is really proactive. This is really great stuff. So anyway, a big tip once again of the cycling cap to New York City, because they are growing rapidly into a very bike-friendly place. And how nice to see, because if you've ever tried to drive a car through the city, you know that that is not an easy thing to do, as is the same in Boston, too. You find that riding your bicycle in Boston is a lot faster than driving a car in Boston, not to mention the fact that it's such a nicer way to get through the city, because Boston is so congested and messy, and as are a lot of the cities. So anyway, lots of good things going on in New York City. Thank you, Tony, for sharing this with me. It's a very long article. There's a lot of good information in there. I recommend that you check it out. It is a New York Times article, and you will find the title of the article is More New York Voters, More New Yorkers Opting for Life in the Bike Lane. So cool. Yay, yay. So I happen to look around a little bit more, and I found a few other little things. Again, you know, I mentioned Oregon, and we have mentioned in a rant a few weeks back about the tax thing in Oregon. And of course, you know, there was a thing in one of my industry magazines that popped out, Oregon's tax law, what it means and what happens now. This was actually written by, a gentleman who is, his name is John Wachunas. And he works for a marketing. He works for a company called Spinlister, and Spinlister is a company that, if you travel to different cities, you can rent bicycles if you want to commute around the city and do that sort of thing. So anyway, he mentioned here, brace yourself, it's tax time. Earlier this month, Oregon passed a highly publicized, highly controversial bicycle tax, first statewide measure of its kind in U.S. history. Understandably, the response has been charged on both sides of the cycling spectrum, particularly considering the fact that Portland, Oregon is the home to the highest bicycle commuter percentage in the country among big cities. So what does that mean to the cycling community at large? Well, in order to better understand the issue, we have to take a look at some of the most common questions that surround it, starting with the most basic. So there's a bunch of questions here and some answers that go along with it. First question is, what or whom exactly does bicycle tax apply to? And Oregon's $15 excise bicycle tax applies to new bike purchases over $200 that have a wheel diameter of 26 inches or more. That's pretty much means any bike not sold by mass merchants in like discount outlets and toy stores. And this was all passed as part of a landmark $5.3 billion transportation bill. How much annual revenue will it generate? According to state estimates, Oregon should see an extra $1.2 million raised every year thanks to bicycle tax. But that is minus a $100,000 administrative expense. So a little over $1 million is what we're talking about. What's the money allocated towards? Theoretically, the tax will be used to fund Connect Oregon Initiative, a group whose stated mission is to invest in air, rail, marine, transit, and bicycle pedestrian infrastructure. Given the state's unfunded pension liability problems, however, a looming deficit, which stood at $22 billion back in 2015, there's some skepticism that all the money will find its way into its intended destination. And why was the bicycle tax levied in the first place? The common thinking is that since bicyclists use public roadways but are exempt from payments such as vehicle registration fees or gas taxes, they should bear some responsibility for the upkeep of the infrastructure. Oh, where do I begin? Well, we'll begin with the next question. Does this argument hold water? And the answer is yes and no. Obviously, cyclists, like everyone else, are responsible for the upkeep of utilities such as bike lanes, public roadways, etc. Things get a little contentious, however, when you break down the details. First of all, many Oregon cyclists are vehicle owners as well, up to 90%, by the way, according to a 2009 survey. That means that the vast majority of them do, in fact, pay the same maintenance costs as non-cyclists. Furthermore, when you look at the mathematics behind roadway wear and tear, there's a stark contrast between the physical effects of driving and cycling. It all has to do with the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. That's AASHTO, and it calls it the fourth power rule. You want to hear it? Here it is, the fourth power rule. What is the fourth power rule? Basically, it's a formula used to determine the amount of damage a particular vehicle causes to a paved surface or roadway. According to the AASHTO, damage caused by vehicles is related to the fourth power of their axle weight. So let's take a look at one comparative example. A bicycle with a rider has an axle weight of 100 pounds. So the rider may weigh more, the bike may, and the combination, but the axle weight combined between the two comes out to be about 100 pounds. While an average full-sized SUV, my favorite vehicle, has an axle weight of around 3,000 pounds. That is, so you're basically taking a 5,000 to 6,000 pound vehicle and the axle weights come out to about 3,000 pounds because it distributes the weight out. Plug the numbers into the fourth power rule and we arrive at the following equation. 3,000 to the fourth power, it's $810,000. In other words, an SUV causes over 800,000 times more damage to the paved surfaces than a bicycle. So why aren't they paying for this? Why aren't they the ones that are making the big investment in the infrastructure? I'll stop there. It sounds like a rant week. I've already done this before. I don't want to beat this poor dead horse. But anyway, it does infuriate me when I hear this kind of rationale. Okay, last question here. Will other state legislatures follow Oregon's lead? Now, I'm worried about this because, and it says here, the answer here says it's too early to say. Shortly after the bill's passage, a Colorado Republican lawmaker suggested implementing a similar bike tax in the Centennial State. He has since backed away from the proposal. However, good. More broadly speaking, the city of Colorado Springs has a flat $4 bicycle tax in place since 1988. On its 20th anniversary in 2008, the city's Gazette newspaper published an article lauding the tax and its positive impact on the surrounding trail system. Only time will tell if Oregonians will experience a similar change of heart. So that's the article about Oregon and their tax, and it did pop up in one of my industry magazines, so I thought I would share that with you. It still bothers me that they would even consider going here. The people that destroy the roads, the ones that are causing the biggest damage to our infrastructure are not bicycles. We are not causing an environmental problem. We are not causing an infrastructure problem. We are very clean. We are all taxpayers. We all pay federal tax. Federal tax goes to paying for the roads and highways to a certain percentage in most of the states. And to tax a bicycle is just foul. It's a foul maneuver. I don't like it. And I will move on to my next subject from that point. The next thing that I pulled up is there's this really cool thing going on in, and this is a little bit of a shout out. I was gonna shout this out as on the positive side because it's kind of an interesting thing. But in the state of Idaho, there is something called the Idaho Roll, I think is what they actually call it. And it's you are allowed and have been allowed for 35 years. People riding bicycles in Idaho have been allowed to do something they can't legally do in just about anywhere else in the United States. Do you know what that is, Fran?
No.
No. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Treat stop signs as yields. If you're riding a bicycle in the state of Idaho and you get to a stop sign, and you look and see it's clear that you can roll through, you can yield instead of stop.
That's the law in Idaho?
It's the law 35 years now.
Whoa.
So it's called the Idaho Roll. And it's so after determining it's safe to do so, bicyclists in Boise can coast through stop signs without losing momentum or their balance. This is great because you know what it takes. You got to come to a stop. You got to start over again. You wiggle and you balance. And I mean, an accomplished cyclist, not a problem. Someone who's been doing it for a while, but it is kind of a problem if you can't just do a slow roll through a stop sign. So until June 2017, Idaho was the sole state that permitted this behavior. It's been joined by Delaware through a bill passed in June, not yet signed by the governor. So is California the next one to change the law? An unusual bipartisan bike bill, AB 1103, would permit the Idaho stop, that's what they call it, the Idaho stop, not the Idaho roll, in the Golden State. Idaho and Delaware are fine states, but California is the nation's most populous and arguably most influential. A change in California would create a powerful precedent for reform across the country. Other states that have tried but failed to enact similar legislation, Oregon, Arizona, Colorado, Minnesota, Arkansas, Utah, Oklahoma, and Montana, they've all made attempts. That's an indication that rolling through stops is not confined to just Idaho, Delaware, and California. It's also not rare behavior. A DePaul University study done in Chicago found that 96% of bike riders don't come to a stop. Millions of times a day across the U.S., riders treat stops as yields without catastrophic results. In Idaho, injury collisions have actually decreased after it changed the law and have remained at low levels since. It's safer. It's safer.
So it's safer because if you have to come to a complete stop, you have to clip out, you have to start and stop and all that kind of thing.
And then you're making a decision of waiting for a vehicle coming or not. You may pull out in the vehicle the wrong way. I mean, you may not time it right because you got to start over again. So you're not rolling through. You're not keeping with the flow of traffic.
Right.
So therefore, you're creating a more dangerous situation
by
stopping.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I just thought that was a really cool thing. So the California bill proponents cite a litany of benefits, existing laws, and the existing law is less safe for bike riders. It increases bike riders' exposure to cross traffic, impedes traffic flow by making everyone wait. Current law, if followed, makes trips by bike more arduous and less convenient, and so less likely. So coming to a complete stop instead of coasting through the stops requires expending 25% more energy. So I just was fascinated by this. I had no idea that this existed, and you know, the League of American Bicyclists, which is kind of our go-to for those of us who are into bicycle advocacy in the U.S., neither opposes nor supports states or cities adopting stop as yields laws. The League's policy director, Ken McLeod, said the limiting data that we have from Idaho suggests that the law is beneficial for bicycling, but more data would help inform the debate. The League of American Bicyclists website notes, laws that make cycling easier without having a quantifiable downside should be an easy sell. So, and Alex Lodgeman from the policy director at People for Bikes says the group has no official stance either. His organization favors rules that create predictability. It's a safer environment if everyone knows what everyone else is doing. That's that communication thing. He offered that it would be good if more states experiment. So the California Bicycle Coalition fully supports the bill, and I actually have a piece here on that too. The bike shop owners and industry members who feel California's Stop as Yield legislation would result in a more guilt-free customer and a more favorable societal view of bicycling can support the bill by signing the petition and sending a letter in, blah, blah, blah. And then moving on there, there's an article in the Los Angeles Times, should California allow cyclists to roll through stop signs? Let's give it a try. So again, everyone's kind of looking at this Idaho stop, and they are, looking at the possibility of putting it in, obviously, probably the most bicycle busy state in the country, California. If it goes through there, I think you're going to start seeing it everywhere. And this is a really positive thing. This is so much more positive than taxing a bicycle. I mean, really, let's think about this. If more people can get out on their bikes because they don't have to worry about, you think about this. If you go out and you see someone who's a novice on their bicycle and they're just getting into it and they're just starting out, they're very shaky and they're very weavy on their bikes. They maybe they haven't been on their bike for 20 years, maybe 30 years, maybe 40 years. It happens. You take that break where you have, family, kids, whatever, you've got jobs, you've got things that distract you from your fitness and being on the bicycle because it wasn't really that important to you. And then later in life, you go, hey, wait a second. This bicycle thing is really good. It's good for my knees. It's good for my body. It's good for the environment. It's good for everything. So my health, all these things. And so you pick up a bicycle and you get on it and it's like, whoa, I remember doing this as a kid, but this is a very, very tricky thing to do. So they're a little weavy and all. If they have the opportunity to ride up to a stop sign and look, like, let's say it's a right-hand turn because that's going to be the classic way of going, and they're making a right-hand turn and they look and they've got either plenty of time or there's no one coming the other way, and they can just roll through legally, what harm does it do? It keeps them up. It keeps them balanced. It keeps them pedaling forward. It's safer for all. How many people have you seen come up to a stop sign and tip over? Happens all the time. So this is another thing that is really positive about this. So the Idaho Stop is a law which I'm going to shout out to my friends who are listening from Bike Walk Connecticut, because I know you're out there. I want you to bring this into discussion at Bike Walk Connecticut. I think this should be something we work on right here in the state of Connecticut. I'd love to see it. It makes a lot of sense. I am a big, big stickler for rules of stopping at stop signs when necessary. I actually preach it. I'm if you don't stop at a stop sign and there's vehicles coming and it's obviously not safe, you deal with the wrath of Ron. If you're with me on a ride, I will talk to you about it. I am not shy about that. So anyway, I do believe that laws are there for reasons, but this particular one right here makes a lot more sense. So let's look at this here in Connecticut and see if we can push this forward into our state legislature and see if we can get this to happen, because it just makes a big, big amount of sense. So, you're seeing this in France, did some pilot programs in some of its cities, and Paris eventually adopted the practice. So what happens in Paris? This is not an unusual thing. The it says here motorists should support a test run as well. It may seem counterintuitive, but letting cyclists safely roll through intersections may actually improve the traffic flow on residential streets. Consider the scenario. A bicyclist reaches a four-way intersection before a car approaching on her left. and she has the right of way. The car driver must wait until the law-abiding bike rider comes to a full stop, then slowly gets going again. And if the bicyclist has been allowed to slow but not stop, it would have cut the car's waiting time, not by a lot, but enough to make a difference on a heavily traveled and trafficked residential street in cities like Los Angeles. So, and that's it. You know, you're driving a motorized vehicle, you're a person in a motorized vehicle, and you look out and you see a cyclist at an intersection. And if you're a conscientious driver, we'll quote unquote that one, then you probably will slow down. You will probably be wary of what that person is doing because you really don't know if they're going to pull out in front of you or not. But if there is this law where there's a flow issue and they could just flow out, you can continue on your way and then work your way around the cyclist. And that makes a lot more sense. It just makes a whole lot more sense. So then there's a question, will pedestrians be creamed by bike riders flying through intersections? Probably not. We're not talking about flying through intersections here. We're talking about slow roll. If California bicyclists are already rolling through stop signs routinely, which studies indicate they are, then pedestrians here aren't paying a big price for it now. According to the California Highway Patrol in 2016, there were 119 injury collisions between bicycles and pedestrians in the entire state. That's it? 119 in the entire state, 144 the year before, and 162 in 2014. And since 2014, only two people have been killed in bike-pedestrian collisions. So it's probably not going to be as much of an issue as it is with bicycle-car collisions, which is much more of an issue. So there are some supporter and opponent issues here. And they agree there's a lot of confusion among motorists about the rules regarding bicycles. I can tell you that because I often will confront a motorist with, can I have a few moments of your time to talk to you about bicycle law? And when I get done talking to them and explain the basics of bicycle law, many people who drive cars and trucks were completely unaware and thank me for introducing them to the laws because there's no way to tell. It brings it up on another can of worms. It brings up another thing that I really think should be required in not just one state, being the state that I'm in, but in all states, and that is when you get your new registration for your motorized vehicle or your new driver's license for your motorized vehicle, there should be a small slip of paper in the inside of that envelope that simply states what the new bicycle and pedestrian laws are if there have been changes. It's a no-brainer. It costs nothing to do. It's really, really inexpensive. Put it in there. Let people know. There's no way for you to know. I know that Fran didn't. I mean, last time she took a driver's test was when? I don't know. Long time ago, right?
I was 18.
You were 18. Wow, you waited a long time to get your license.
I didn't wait a long time to get my, don't even get
me started. Your parents waited you a long time to get your license.
I only got it when I was 18 because, no, my story is very sad. They had driver's ed in school. So they had, you know, they didn't give you road testing, but they gave you the literature.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took the test in school when I was probably 16.
Yeah.
You know, when you could get your permit.
Uh-huh.
And I aced it. I got 100%.
Of course you did. You ace everything.
And then my parents wouldn't let me get in the car.
They wouldn't let you do the practical.
Wouldn't let me do the practical. So, and they wouldn't let me, they wouldn't let me, they wouldn't let me. And then, they taught me, and the time I wasn't able to use the test because the time limit had run out. So I had to retake it.
You had to take it all over again.
I had to take it again, and I only got a 70. I passed, but I only got a 70. And then my parents tried to teach me, and then I took the test, and I didn't pass my driver's test the first time.
Yep.
And so then I went to driving school. And then I passed.
That's
and
right.
It took till I was 18.
I didn't pass the written the first time. I had to go back and do it again.
Right.
Because I hate being tested. But you brought up a point. That's in that conversation that you just had, you brought up a really good point. 2 years later, you took the same test that you aced and you got a 70% on it.
Right.
So you're starting to see where I'm going with this? So here's the deal. If you had your driver's license test back when you were 16, 17, 18 years of age,
yeah.
Okay, and now you are 40, 50, or 60 years of age, let's just, you know, choose some numbers, yes, some round numbers out there, what would you know about the changes in bicycle law?
And there's another
Nothing.
Issue. There's another issue. I took the test in New Jersey.
Oh, okay. And there's a different
I'm
law.
Now in Connecticut.
Right.
Right. The laws may be different.
Different
I don't
laws
know.
Laws in different states.
Right.
Right. Right.
And
could
when
be.
You usually they have, because I've had driver's licenses in a number of jurisdictions. I've had New Jersey, Oregon, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and now Connecticut. So I don't think I had to take it. I'm not sure if I had to take a test in Oregon. I'm not sure I had to take a test anywhere. Again,
right,
they have reciprocity.
Right.
Once you have your license, you just pay your money and they give you a new license.
And you make another good point. Let's take, in case in point, our good friends in Montana. Good morning, Senator Sales. How are you today? They hate bicycles. Well, there are some there that hate bicycles. The people that work for Bike Walk Montana love bicycles and understand and do lots of good things. And hello, Melinda, if you're listening. This is a good thing. But their laws, they don't have a 3-foot law. We have a 3-foot law. We have a 3-foot extended law.
Montana doesn't have a three.
No, because Senator Scott Sales boxed it out. He made it go away.
They can buzz you legally in Montana?
So they can do whatever they want to you in Montana,
nice,
apparently. You know, there's a 3-foot law that is in a number of states now. Connecticut has an expanded 3-foot law where not only do you have to give the cyclist 3 feet worth of space, but you also are under the dependence of the cyclist making the decision as to where they should be on the road. So they may be out in the roadways because of impending danger on the side of the road, and it is legal in Connecticut to cross that yellow line. I've stated this a number of times because I want people to hear this and get it in their heads. And when they have that discussion with the motorized vehicle and the driver of that motorized vehicle, the person who is driving that, I want them to be sure that they pass on the information that it's okay for them to cross the yellow line in the situation of passing a cyclist on the road. It is not illegal for them any longer. And so it's, you know, Connecticut has been really good about this. They're very proactive about their cycling laws. And I think that Connecticut should be the state that sets the precedent like the state of Idaho did with the stop and yield. I think we should set precedent for the putting paperwork in all of the DMV notifications that go out to people who are re-registering or relicensing themselves so they understand what the new laws are. So another shout out there to my friends over at Bike Walk Connecticut. Are you listening? Let me know. Contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. If you've heard this, I would love to hear from you. But this is something that we could do and we could move forward with, and we could teach the rest of the country a grand new idea of something that's really positive and good for everyone involved. So moving back to that situation there with the driver's license and not really knowing and how quickly we forget, it's obvious, you know, maybe we need to have refresher courses. I'm not a big proponent of this because I drive a motorized vehicle and I don't want to have to go and take a driver's test every couple of years. But then again, now that I've reached an age where I can take a driver's test again through a particular organization, the AARP. Yes, I'm old. I can get a reduced rate on my insurance if I pass the test. So there's bonuses to this too. But maybe if it was more of a requirement every 10 years, even, it's not. I'm not talking about a lot here. But, you know, just update yourself on what's going on out there in the laws. And if you're going to be driving that vehicle, of course, pretty soon the vehicle will be driving you. And so now your car will have to take the driver's test. And how's that work? I don't know. That just frightens me. I don't even want to get into that one because, you know, I looked into the, you know, somebody said, yeah, but, you know, when you've got these really smart cars, these driverless cars that are driving down the road, you're gonna have less problems with your riding your bike there because, you know, the car is going to see you and it's going to be able to avoid you. And it's not going to drift into your lane because it's going to have lane cameras. And here's how those lane cameras work. If there is a white line that or a yellow line that is placed in the road, then your car, even your new car now, which has an alarm that goes off that tells you that you have drifted into a lane, it will go off and it will alert you. But if you are driving your car on a road like we live on, which is a back road, okay, with no white lines on the sides of the road, and there are many, many roads right. like that, that car has no idea where it is on the right side of the car. So not smart enough yet, cars, is what I'm calling it. Not smart cars, but not smart enough yet, cars. And I think that there's a lot of bugs that have to be worked out there. How are they going to see me, the cyclist? If you have any idea how that works, if you have any information on it, please email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. I am just open for discussion on this.
Well, this lane departure, but don't they don't recognize other vehicles or other cycle or other people or
nope.
So it's just lane departure.
Lane departure.
What
that's
sense does
it.
That make?
Okay. Good. Let's talk about that. What
well,
sense does that make?
I'm just trying to think. Like, you know, I don't have the car that I have now doesn't have a backup camera or lane departure. And I think that the next car I get, I'm going to get it.
Well, it'll probably
like
be
it
in all cars at that point. It's going to be a standard.
But
right?
I travel to Florida a lot. And every time I go, I rent a vehicle. And most of the time, the car has a backup camera.
Yeah.
And it does seem to notice stuff that's behind me. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's a bush or it's another car or doesn't have to be a lane.
I think that's a different item though.
Okay.
Okay? Because lane departure is based on lines and lanes in
right.
the road.
Okay? And it would make sense if lane departure also noticed stuff.
Right.
People and things
but
and
it
vehicles.
It doesn't look there. The camera is actually built into the side view mirror.
Oh.
And it looks down.
Then you need cameras that look out.
Well, And my point exactly.
It has to
but
be the
then,
same camera that's in the back of the car.
Well, you would think that that would be a wise decision. But at this time, as much as I know, and if you have more information, please let me know. But as far as I know, there is not an indicator to your sides with the
right.
cameras at this time. Now, maybe the self-driving cars have more to them than just
yeah.
the lane departures. Just because they are self-driving cars and they need to be able to see everything. I really don't understand the technology. I will say that I really don't want to understand the technology. I prefer to drive my car as I prefer to ride my bike. I would like to be in control of that situation and not have computers be in control of it. But, you know, we're moving forward here. We're definitely moving forward. And, you know, when we walk into our houses now, we can shout out to our house and tell it to turn lights on and off. And we can tell it to do different things and change the heat and do all this. The technology is going at a very, very rapid pace. And I'm hoping that the self-driving car technology is also moving at that same pace. I know that they still are not ready to put these things on the road forever. So we're still waiting on that one. But as a cyclist, as a pedestrian, I worry a lot about this because it's, you know, it's certainly an area of concern. But anyway, so those are a few things that I've pulled up here that I thought would be interesting to speak of today. I'm going to have a few things coming up in the future here. So I'm gonna shout out a few things to start with. I will have some guests on soon from the Steeplechase Bike Tour, which is coming up in August this month right now.
It's a week from Saturday.
It's a week from Saturday. It's September 16th is the Steeplechase. So I believe, actually, it might be next week.
No, that I it's 19th.
Then no, I'm looking at the wrong thing. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong thing. Yes. sorry, I was looking at the wrong thing. Yes. It's August 19th. You're right, August 19th. So there are some really cool things going on here, and I wanna shout this out right now because if you have never participated in this event before, I highly encourage it this year. The reason being that we have a major donor sponsor of the ride, the Jeffrey Austin Foundation, and Jeff was kind enough to leave a lot of money behind. in his departure, and his wife is running the foundation right now. And so they're very, very generous, and they have generously given us a large donation to the ride. But they are also doing a dollar-for-dollar match on fundraising. So if you raise money if you raise a dollar, they'll give a dollar. So every dollar is worth another dollar, which is really, really cool and super generous of them. And so this is the year to do the steeplechase. And if this becomes a standard, then this is a really wonderful thing because it benefits a lot of really special people that need help. And we're not getting help from our government any longer because of various reasons. I won't get too political here. But remember, that ride, which is August 19th, 2017, contains a five-mile walk and or ride. You can choose to do either or. A 20-mile ride, a 35-mile ride, a 50-mile ride, a 62-mile ride, which is 100 kilometers, and a 100-mile ride. So if you love to ride your bike or if you just want to try out one of these things, I really encourage it. It's the Steeplechase Bike Tour. There is a Facebook page. There is a website also, steeplechasebiketour.org. So check it out. It's a cool thing. It's local. You want to see Northeastern Connecticut like we see it? Come out. Come out and play. It's our roads. We're showing you the beauty of Northeastern Connecticut, the quiet of Northeastern Connecticut, the roads that time has forgotten. So I know I spent some time on that, but it's important, and I thought we needed to mention it. Another thing that I'm going to shout out to as I work my way towards the end of the show is I want to remind those of you who have this absurd passion with riding your bicycles off-road on a road bike, it's cyclocross season. And cyclocross season is a passion of mine. It is something that I used to participate in many years ago. Now I just ride for fun off-road, but I am involved in a couple of different races, and I want to mention some of the things that are going on. If you don't know what cyclocross is, I will tell you right now, it is a ride where it is a race that you are contained within an hour or less on a predetermined course, and it is timed. So it may be a 40-minute race or a 45-minute race, and when the officials decide that you've been out there long enough, basically they ring a bell and say last lap and that's it. And it is a race of decisions off-road. So the decisions that you make are with barriers that are put down on the course. So you'll have to probably dismount your bike and hop off and jump over the barriers and then remount your bicycle and continue moving forward. And there will also be some areas where the steepness of the terrain will be so difficult that you'll probably have to run and carry your bike up the hill. There are very tricky descents and there are off cambered sections. There's all sorts of interesting things that make you learn how to ride your bike better. And it's very challenging. It is not only challenging physically and aerobically, but also it is challenging for decision-making as to how am I going to ride through this section of the course, that sort of thing. If you want to see this in action, and you're in New England, if you're a New England listener, we rock here. We've got it all. We have more cyclocross than anywhere else in the country. It was developed many, many years ago by a handful of guys like myself who decided that we really love this and wanted to have races of our own, and that's where it all started. But right now, New England is one of the hotbeds, or is the hotbed, for cyclocross in the country. There are other hot areas for it. There's quite a factor growing just south of us down in, I think really more like around the like Baltimore, Maryland, D.C. kind of area. I think North Carolina, South Carolina's got a thing going on. I know Denver, Colorado, the whole Colorado region has got a thing going on for cross. The Northwest, Oregon, Washington, they have what we like to call prime conditions for cyclocross because it's usually damp there. It's often raining there. And of course, if you're a tried and true veteran of cyclocross, you pray for days like that on race day because it makes the course even trickier to ride and increases your skill chances, if you are a skillful rider, of doing well in a race like that. So cyclocross is very interesting. If you don't know anything about it, you can Google it and you will find numerous videos and information out there. But the reason I am talking about it today is because I have a few other things coming up. One is the Hartford Riverfront Cyclocross, which is in Hartford, Connecticut at Riverfront Park. It is Saturday, September 9th, and it is an all-day event. There are races going on all day long, and I will be there. You will find that is the same area that the National Championships of 2017, which were back in January, were held. So it is not going to be the same course, but it will have some similarity to it because I am also the course designer on that. That is on September 9th. Moving beyond that, there are a number of cross races almost every weekend, but the next really big one, and this is one of the largest races in New England, and that is the KMC Crossfest on September 28th through October 1st. It is a very large race. It's a UCI race. It draws thousands of riders in, and it is in the Thompson Motorsport Speedway in Thompson, Connecticut. Used to be in Providence for many, many years, and then it got moved out to Thompson over the last year, basically. It got moved out to Thompson. And along with that is an event on that Friday evening, which is called the Builder's Ball. And we had Eric Weiss from the Builder's Ball on the air last year. We will have him on the air again this year. He has already contacted me. We already have him scheduled to be on the air and talk more about the Builder's Ball being a really cool thing where a lot of the custom frame builders, hand-built people that build bikes from pile of tubes up until the finished product, will be showing their wares and talking about building, and there's lots of fun stuff there. So I'll have Eric on to talk more about that. It's a really cool event, and I highly recommend going to that because it really kind of gives you the roots of the whole bicycle idea. So it's good. Beyond that, on October 7th, we have Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross, which is right here in our town of Mansfield. It is a classic. It has been around since the year 1983. It was first founded and started by me, and I will be there also for the Mansfield Hollow Cyclocross, and that is being presented by the Friends of Mansfield Hollow State Park this year. And then the weekend after that, there is the Gloucester Grand Prix of Cross in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and that is on October 14th and 15th. Another one of those very, very large cyclocross races. It's like a festival. There's a lot of stuff going on besides just the race. If you're into bikes in any way, you must come and see these. These are really, really fun to go to. And bring your cowbell, by the way. Cowbells are required when you go to a cross
race. More cowbell!
More cowbell. Yes, I knew that was coming. I knew. Squeezing in the middle of all of that, on September 16th, 2017, we have the new Ashford Metric Gravel Grinder. Not quite as severe as cyclocross, but certainly a way to ride your bicycle on dirt roads. And I will have more information on that in the future because I believe I'm going to have some guests on that one too to talk that up. So lots of things coming up. And yes, cyclocross season is coming. We will also have guests on, I believe, next week for the Steeplechase Bike Tour, and we'll talk a little bit more about that and get more information out to you about that. My name is Pedlin' Ron, and you have been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, the bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. Remember, you can reach me by emailing to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you'd like to contribute or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedlin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs.